The Briefing Desk, 17 April 2026. Intro. Imagine a single week in which the world's most consequential oil export corridor is closed. One of Europe's most disruptive political figures loses power after 16 years, and a country fighting for its survival launches more long-range drones into its adversary's territory than that adversary launches back, for the first time in more than 4 years of war. This is not a hypothetical scenario. This is the world as of the 17th of April, 2026. Welcome to the Briefing Desk. I'm your editorial anchor. No byline, no opinion, no speculation. What you will hear in the next half hour is a measured, sourced account of the developments that matter most right now, drawn from named reporting and attributed analysis. We do not guess, we do not editorialize, we report what the record shows. Today, we are covering four interlocking stories that are reshaping the strategic landscape in real time. Ukraine's deep strike campaign has now reached a geographic scale and industrial depth that multiple sources describe as historically unprecedented, and the cumulative damage to Russian oil infrastructure is being measured not in percentage points, but in millions of barrels per day permanently offline. Simultaneously, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has compressed global oil supply from a second direction entirely, and the World Trade Organization's Director General is now publicly revising downward her projections for global trade growth as a direct consequence. In Budapest, an opposition leader has just dismantled 16 years of entrenched political power, and the immediate consequence for European Union governance and the financing of Ukraine's war effort is substantial. And in the Mediterranean, a new operational front has quietly opened that is already drawing formal objections from 9 European governments. We begin where the most acute military and economic disruption is concentrated, the deep interior of Russia. Body, Segment 1, Ukraine's Deep Strike Campaign. On the 21st of February of this year, Ukraine struck the Vatkins missile plant, a facility located in Russia's Udmurt Republic, approximately 1,400 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. The BBC confirmed the strike through satellite imagery, identifying a large hole in the workshop roof of the facility. Fabian Hoffman, a doctoral research fellow at the University of Oslo, told the Kyiv Independent that this marked the first time Ukraine had successfully targeted a core node of Russia's missile industrial base using a heavy missile capability. The weapon used was the Flamingo cruise missile, a Ukrainian design system that, according to the International Institute for Strategic Studies as cited by the military show, carries a warhead of 1,150 kilograms and has an operational range of approximately 3,000 kilometers. To put that in context, Valery Romanenko, a senior researcher at the State Aviation Museum, assessed to the military show that this range places roughly 90% of Russia's military-industrial complex within reach of Ukrainian strikes. That is not a marginal capability. That is a structural shift in what this war can do. The production numbers tell part of the story. The New Voice of Ukraine reported that as of August 2025, Ukraine was targeting a production rate of 50 Flamingo missiles per month. By November 2025, the manufacturer, a company called Firepoint, was claiming a rate of 3 per day, according to the same sourcing through the military show. The unit cost is estimated at approximately $500,000 per missile, compared with approximately $1.4 million for US Tomahawk. That cost differential is not incidental. It is central to the logic of the entire campaign. But it is the oil infrastructure strikes that have generated the most consequential strategic damage, and the reporting here is detailed enough to walk through facility by facility. On approximately the 2nd of March, Ukraine struck the Sheshkaris oil terminal in Novorossiysk. According to the military show, that terminal handles up to 700,000 barrels of oil per day. 3 weeks later, on the 21st of March, Ukraine struck the Saratov-Rosneft refinery, damaging a secondary processing unit, a 10,000-ton diesel storage tank, and approximately 400 square meters of storage infrastructure. 2 days after that, on the 23rd and 25th of March, Ukraine struck the Primorsk and Ust-Luga terminals in the Leningrad region. Ust-Luga, per the same reporting, is capable of handling approximately 700,000 barrels per day and processes up to 45 billion cubic meters of natural gas annually. And on the 26th of March, more than 20 Ukrainian drones struck the Kirishi refinery near St. Petersburg, identified by the military show as Russia's second largest refinery by processing capacity, with output of approximately 380,000 barrels per day. The cumulative picture is striking. The military show, citing Reuters and other outlets, describes the aggregate effect as the most severe oil supply disruption in modern Russian history. Russia's oil export capacity has been reduced by 40%, equivalent to approximately 2 million barrels per day. The Volgograd refinery, which processes between 280,000 and 300,000 barrels per day, remained completely offline as of end March with no restart timeline. The same was true of the Kyrgyzstan and Yaroslavl facilities. Yaroslavl alone accounts for approximately 300,000 barrels per day. The military show cites an estimate, the specific origin of which it does not fully identify, that Russian President Vladimir Putin is losing between $50 and $100 million per day as a direct result of this damage. That figure is corroborated in part by Dr. Jason Smart, identified as a national security advisor and special correspondent appearing on the Jason J. Smart channel, who states that Ukraine's strikes have contributed to a 45% decline in Russian oil revenues in the current year. Dr. Smart does not attribute that specific figure to a named external publication, and the desk notes that distinction. But the directional alignment between his assessment and the military show's infrastructure reporting is notable. Building on the oil story, there is a broader drone volume development worth examining carefully. ABC News, as cited by the War and Politics 24 channel, reported that Ukraine launched more long-range drones into Russia during March than Russia launched into Ukraine, the first such reversal since the war began in February 2022. The figures, as reported by ABC News, show Russia intercepting 7,347 Ukrainian drones in March, averaging approximately 237 per day. Ukraine, by contrast, reported Russia launched 6,462 drones and 138 missiles into Ukraine during the same period, averaging approximately 208 drones per day. ABC News was careful to flag significant methodological limitations with these figures. The two datasets measure different things. Both governments have institutional interests in the numbers they report. The desk reflects that caveat to you now. What the figures suggest directionally, however, is a meaningful shift in operational tempo and reach.
President Zelensky, speaking on the 1st of March, and cited by Pravda as reported through the military show, framed the Russian side of the equation in stark terms. Russia used more than 1,720 attack drones, nearly 1,300 guided aerial bombs, and over 100 missiles in the final week of February alone. And across the three winter months of December through February, Russia launched nearly 19,000 attack drones against Ukraine, alongside 738 missiles. The Moscow Times separately reported that Russia fired more missiles into Ukraine in February than in any prior month, a 113% increase over the 135 missiles launched in January. The picture that emerges is of a war in which both sides are escalating the industrial volume of their strikes, but in which Ukraine has for the first time achieved parity or better in long-range drone exchange, while simultaneously landing precision strikes on facilities that the Russian military depends on for the revenue that funds the war itself. A less publicized but strategically significant front has opened in the Mediterranean, and it is already producing diplomatic friction within the European Union. Radio France International, RFI, the French state-owned international broadcaster, reported that Ukraine established a military presence in Libya no later than November 2025, under an agreement between Kiev and the internationally recognized Government of National Unity in Tripoli. The military show cited that RFI reporting. According to two Libyan sources who spoke to RFI, more than 200 Ukrainian military experts and officers are currently deployed across three sites in Libya. The first is the Libyan Air Force Academy in Misrata, a facility that also hosts presences from Italian forces, Turkish forces, British intelligence, and U.S. Africa Command. The second is a facility in Zawiya, approximately 50 kilometers north of Tripoli, equipped for aerial and naval drone launch operations. The third is a coastal site under active construction, with antenna systems and runways already installed, per the same sourcing. The operational implications became clear through two specific incidents. Ukraine's security service publicly claimed a strike on the 19th of December 2025 against a vessel identified as the Russian Shadow Fleet tanker Kandil in international waters between Malta and Greece, stating the ship had circumvented Western sanctions. Then, in a more consequential incident, the LNG carrier Arctic Metagas, carrying 60,000 tons of liquefied natural gas, was struck by what Russia attributed to Ukrainian naval drones launched from Libya. The drone used, per the military show, citing reporting from El País, carried up to 300 kilograms of explosives and had a range of approximately 800 kilometers. That range specification, as El País noted, physically precludes the launch point being anywhere on Ukrainian territory. It points to Libya. The consequences of the Arctic Metagas strike extended well beyond the vessel itself. Euronews reported on the 4th of April that the ship's crew was evacuated by Maltese authorities. A subsequent Libyan towing operation failed after the tow cable snapped, leaving the vessel adrift. Nine European Union member states, led by Italy, formally ejected to the strike, citing the potential environmental consequences of a 60,000-ton LNG carrier in distress in Mediterranean waters. The World Wildlife Fund raised specific concerns about ecological disaster. The strategic and financial rationale for the Ukraine-Libya partnership is not difficult to reconstruct. The Center for Strategic and International Studies estimated that Russia's Shadow Fleet, the network of vessels used to circumvent oil sanctions, generates between $87 and $100 billion in annual revenue. CSIS assessed that figure as matching or exceeding the total Western military aid provided to Ukraine since February 2022. Disrupting that revenue stream through direct interdiction is, by that logic, a high-return operation. More importantly, the Ukraine-Libya agreement is not limited to strike operations. The Kyiv Independent, as cited by the military show, reported the agreement also includes provisions for Ukrainian training of Libyan forces in drone operations, investment in Libya's oil sector, and a future arms sales commitment contingent on the war's conclusion. This is a partnership structure, not a transactional arrangement. For Russia, the Libya dimension is complicated by prior commitments. Russia had established ties with Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army, and the Wagner Group had fought alongside Haftar's forces. By January 2025, Russia was relocating soldiers and equipment into Libya following the fall of Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria, per the military show. The Guardian, cited in the same sourcing, described Libya as a transit point Russia uses to channel weapons into Sudan. Ukraine's military presence in Libya, therefore, is not only a revenue disruption operation, it is an insertion into a theater where Russian logistics are already active. Amin Ayyub, identified as a Middle East Forum fellow writing for the Times of Israel, characterized Ukraine's Libya operations as a calculated transformation aimed at establishing a forward operating base and called for a UN mandate governing all foreign military presences in the country. Segment 3. Russia's internal strain. Beyond the battlefield and the energy infrastructure picture, a set of figures describing Russia's internal condition has emerged, though the desk must be clear that many of these figures come from a single source without independent corroboration from named external publications. Dr. Jason Smart, appearing on the Jason J. Smart channel and identified as a national security advisor and special correspondent, presents a picture of accelerating systemic stress inside Russia. On the military side, Dr. Smart states Russia suffered approximately 25,000 soldiers killed in the first quarter of this year alone, a rate of approximately 278 deaths per day, or one death every 5 minutes. He further states that military recruitment has declined from approximately 1,200 new recruits per day historically to approximately 800 per day. The territorial efficiency figures he cites are perhaps even more telling. Russian forces acquired 319 kilometers of territory in January, but only 123 kilometers in February. The personnel cost per unit of territory gained increased by 556% between January and March. He frames this in comparative terms. In 2024, Russia was losing one soldier per 16,900 meters of territory gained. Currently, that ratio has tripled, one soldier per 5,200 meters. The war is becoming dramatically more expensive for Russia in human terms per this account, even as it continues.
On fiscal matters, Dr. Smart states that Moscow consumed 121% of its full-year deficit plan within 90 days. Russia's central bank, per his account, is forecasting a current account surplus of approximately $10 billion. But household inflation tells a different story, 13.1% for February and 13.4% for March, against the central bank's stated target of 4% for the year. Dr. Smart further states that one-third of Russians report insufficient funds for food, a figure that, if accurate, would indicate significant social strain at the household level. Building on that picture, it is worth noting what Russian industry is simultaneously producing. Dr. Smart cites Rostec company data showing 2024 revenue rising 27% to approximately $46 billion, with 99.5% of defense orders fulfilled. The military-industrial complex has to date maintained production volumes even as Ukraine targets it. The FSB, per Dr. Smart, has arrested over 17 Russian generals since the war began and is expanding its influence over key industries. For a ground-level assessment, former U.S. Marine Matthew Sampson, interviewed in Kyiv by the War and Politics 24 channel, offered a view of the current frontline situation. He assessed that Ukrainian fortifications in the Zaporizhia region are substantial and effective, and that Russian forces are consistently failing to advance through them. He described a mine roller observed in Ukrainian use that had sustained between 80 and 100 detonations without requiring repair, citing commander video footage as his source. Sampson assessed that Russian forces are unlikely to accomplish significant territorial gains before Russia's 9th of May Victory Day celebrations, despite what the interviewer noted, attributing the claim to President Zelensky, was a stated Russian objective to occupy Chasiv Yar, Pokrovsk, and the Kostantinovnica region by end of April. On the Easter ceasefire, the War and Politics 24 interviewer stated that Ukrainian officials reported Russia violated the 30-hour pause thousands of times. Sampson said Ukrainian forces remained at full readiness throughout. Segment 4. Hungary's political earthquake. Now to Budapest, and to a political development whose implications extend well beyond Hungary's borders. Opposition leader Peter Magyar's Tisza party has won a two-thirds parliamentary majority in Hungary, ending 16 years of Viktor Orbán's rule. The result was reported by the War and Politics 24 channel, citing Professor Skoltukas, identified as a professor of international relations. The Kremlin responded cautiously, stating it hopes to maintain pragmatic relations with Hungary's new leadership.
To understand why this matters at the European level, it is necessary to understand what Orbán was doing with Hungary's membership in the European Union. During his tenure, Orbán delayed or blocked EU decisions on sanctions against Russia, military aid packages, and financial support for Ukraine. The unanimity requirement in key EU decision-making processes gave Hungary, a single member state, effective veto power over collective European action. Orbán used that power repeatedly. Professor Skultukas identified three immediate structural consequences of the TISA victory. The first and most immediate is financial. The new TISA supermajority could lift Hungary's blockade on a 90 billion euro loan intended to finance Ukraine's operations through 2027, a loan that Orbán had been blocking since December. 90 billion euros, blocked by a single government. That blockade may now be lifted. The second consequence relates to sanctions. Skultukas assessed the result likely means less Hungarian opposition to EU sanctions against Russia, though he was careful to note that Magyar did not specifically address the sanctions question in his post-election press conference. The direction of travel has changed, the precise pace has not yet been declared. The third consequence is what the result does not mean. Skultukas was explicit, the TISA victory does not signal acceleration of Ukraine's EU accession process. Magyar made this position clear in his own messaging, and Skultukas noted that other member states also oppose accelerated accession. The door has not opened on that question. One detail in the sourcing is worth pausing on. The War in Politics 24 reporting noted that U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance visited Budapest the week before the election, in what Professor Skultukas characterized as an effort to bolster Orbán ahead of the vote. That intervention appears to have been unsuccessful. Skultukas described Orbán's defeat as a setback for what he characterized as a global network of hard-right politicians. He identified Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico as another EU leader with a pro-Kremlin orientation, but assessed Slovakia as carrying considerably less political weight within the Union than Hungary. The Promethean Updates channel separately noted, citing no named institutional source, that the EU moved to present Hungary with 27 conditions tied to the release of frozen funds and is moving to eliminate member state veto power over EU decisions. The desk cannot independently verify those specific claims from the transcript, and we flag that distinction for you. Segment 5. The Strait of Hormuz and Global Trade. The Strait of Hormuz closure has introduced a second major supply shock into an energy market already being compressed by Ukraine strikes on Russian oil infrastructure. The two disruptions are not connected operationally, but their effects compound. The Strait of Hormuz carries approximately 20 million barrels per day, representing 1/5 of total global oil consumption. When that passage is closed, there is no simple rerouting option. To understand why, consider the alternative bypass infrastructure that was activated. Drone strikes on Fujairah on the 3rd of March took the UAE's ADNOC pipeline offline by the 14th of March. Strikes on Saudi pumping stations constrained the Petroline, a 750-mile overland pipeline. The combined maximum throughput of both pipeline bypasses is approximately 9 million barrels per day. That is less than half of what the strait carries. The situation then escalated further. Houthi forces entered the conflict on the 28th of March, threatening the Bab el-Mandeb, an 18-mile choke point between Yemen and the African coast, through which Saudi oil transiting via the Petroline route must pass to reach global markets. The Suez Canal, described in the same sourcing as carrying 15% of global trade and nearly 1/3 of Asia-Europe container shipping, became functionally compromised because accessing it requires traversal of the Houthi-threatened Red Sea corridor. Per reporting cited by the Jillian Michaels channel, U.S. retail gasoline prices are reported as holding between approximately $3.60 and $4.15 per gallon, against a global oil price described as having surpassed $120 per barrel, with Gulf Coast refineries running at 95% capacity and U.S. oil exports surging to an estimated 5.2 million barrels per day.
WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala addressed these compounding disruptions directly, speaking at a CSIS Global Development Department Future Summit event cited by both the CSIS and Center for Strategic and International Studies channels. Her headline figure, the WTO now projects a 0.5 percentage point reduction in trade growth from a baseline projection of 1.9% to 1.4% if disruption linked to the Iran conflict continues. That may sound like a small number. At the scale of a $33 to $35 trillion global trade economy, as Okonjo-Iweala characterized it, that is a very large amount of economic activity. For context, she noted that actual global goods trade growth for the prior year came in at 4.6%, nearly double the WTO's projection of 2.4%. She attributed that outperformance to two factors, AI-related goods accounting for 42% of growth, and significant front-loading of purchases ahead of anticipated tariffs. The current year projection of 1.9% was already cautious before the Hormuz disruptions began. It is now 1.4%. Okonjo-Iweala separately flagged fertilizer shipments as her primary food security concern. Missed planting seasons, she warned, could reduce crop productivity and drive food price increases, a cascading consequence of maritime disruption that extends well beyond oil markets. She also framed the structural problem in terms that deserve attention. The world is over-dependent on a small number of choke points. She identified the Hormuz, the Strait of Malacca, the Panama Canal, and the Suez Canal as collectively representing a systemic vulnerability. When two of those four are simultaneously compromised, as appears to be the case now, the exposure is not theoretical.
She also noted approximately 100 carbon border adjustment mechanisms now existing across jurisdictions globally, with the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism drawing concern from WTO members as a potentially trade-restrictive measure, adding a regulatory layer to the existing physical supply disruptions. One dimension of global trade that is structurally less exposed to these choke point risks is worth noting: digitally delivered services. Okonjo-Iweala cited this as a $5.3 trillion sector, growing at 6% per year globally and at 15% annually in Africa. As physical route vulnerability becomes more acute, that trajectory is likely to draw increased policy attention. Briefly on the institutional dimension, the WTO's 14th Ministerial Conference, hosted by Cameroon in Yaoundé, concluded with significant process but limited breakthrough, a combination that Okonjo-Iweala herself described as difficult but substantively meaningful. The most visible unresolved issue was the 28-year-old moratorium prohibiting customs duties on electronic transmissions. 164 of the 166 WTO members reached what Okonjo-Iweala described as a landing zone on the issue, but the conference ran 12 hours beyond its scheduled close before adjourning without resolution, with the work returned to Geneva with no stated timeline. In WTO terms, near unanimity can still mean deadlock when the remaining two members hold their ground. Attendance fell relative to the previous ministerial, 102 ministers in Yaoundé, 77 full ministers and 25 vice ministers, compared with 120 ministers at MC13 in Abu Dhabi. Okonjo-Iweala noted this in her remarks. What did advance was a reform package developed over 9 months by Geneva ambassadors, including 6 monthly progress reports and 1 year ministerial review cycle. An interim e-commerce agreement among 66 members was launched at MC14, and the Investment Facilitation for Development Agreement now counts 129 member countries. Okonjo-Iweala was pointed about the structural constraint at the heart of WTO decision-making. The consensus practice, which she described as functioning effectively as unanimity, gives the smallest member equal blocking power to the largest. She identified reform of this practice as a priority, while noting no member seeks to eliminate consensus entirely. The plurilative pathway, agreements among subsets of members, is emerging as the pragmatic alternative when full consensus cannot be achieved. On development, the numbers she cited illuminate the structural imbalances the WTO is navigating. Africa's share of global trade remains below 3%. South-South trade has grown from 10% of global trade in 1995 to 25% currently, a meaningful shift. Latin American and Caribbean exports to Africa represent just 0.31% of their total exports. A meeting between CELAC and African trade ministers was convened in Yaoundé to explore diversification, an initiative Okonjo-Iweala attributed to Colombia's vice president. On the question of negotiations, the sourcing this week converges on a picture of structural deadlock with competing constraints on multiple sides. Matthew Sampson, interviewed by War and Politics 24, assessed that whenever any negotiation process makes contact with Moscow, it falls apart, which he attributed to what he characterized as Russian unwillingness to accept any outcome short of full Ukrainian capitulation. He stated his intention to convey to unnamed U.S. congressional members that, in his assessment, one side is willing to negotiate and the other is not. He characterized a bilateral U.S.-Ukraine military partnership as a more durable security guarantee than either the Budapest Memorandum, which did not hold, or NATO membership, which Ukraine does not currently have. Reuters, as cited by War and Politics 24 and dated to the 25th of March, reported that President Zelensky stated the United States appeared ready to move forward with security guarantees for Ukraine, but only if Ukraine agreed to withdraw from the Donbass region. U.S. officials pushed back on that characterization of their position per the same sourcing. Public opinion polling, as reported by Reuters and cited in the same channel, shows a majority of Ukrainians oppose giving up land even in exchange for stronger security protections. That public opinion constraint is not a peripheral factor, it is a structural one. The War and Politics 24 interviewer noted, per Reuters, that a U.S. sanctions relief measure toward Russia begun approximately 1 month prior may be extended. Sampson assessed this as likely a short-term action aimed at a longer-term strategic objective without providing named attribution for that characterization. He also referenced Operation Spiderweb, described as a Ukrainian intelligence operation that destroyed a significant number of Russian nuclear-capable bombers using low-cost drones, planned over approximately 18 months, as evidence of Ukrainian independent capability that does not rely on U.S. systems such as the Tomahawk missile. This is relevant to the negotiations context, because it speaks to Ukraine's ability to sustain pressure independent of the terms of any U.S. security arrangement. Building on the Hungary story, Professor Skoltukakis assessed that the Tisza supermajority in Budapest changes the EU's internal blocking dynamics in ways that materially affect the negotiating environment. The potential release of the 90 billion euro Ukraine loan and reduced Hungarian vetoes on Russia sanctions both alter the economic and military balance heading into whatever negotiation framework eventually emerges. Outright.
Let us take a moment to draw these threads together. Not as speculation, but as a summary of what the sourced record shows. The first takeaway is about energy as a strategic weapon, deployed simultaneously from two directions. Ukraine's deep strike campaign has removed an estimated 40% of Russia's oil export capacity. The Strait of Hormuz closure has constrained global supply from a completely separate vector. The WTO Director General is now on record projecting trade growth falling from 1.9 to 1.4% as a result. These are not distant economic statistics. They are the financial architecture of the conflict. The second takeaway is about the geographic expansion of this war. Ukraine is no longer fighting only on its own territory or across its eastern border. It has established a military presence in Libya, struck vessels in the Mediterranean, and forced 9 EU governments to formally object. The Libya dimension is early in its development, but the infrastructure, 3 sites, more than 200 personnel, construction underway, suggests this is not a temporary arrangement. The third takeaway is about European institutional capacity. The removal of Viktor Orbán's blocking power inside the European Union is not a symbolic development. The 90 billion euro Ukrainian loan that was frozen since December may now move. The veto dynamic on Russia's sanctions has shifted. Whether this translates into faster action depends on processes that will unfold over coming weeks, but the structural obstacle has changed. The fourth takeaway is about the durability of the current military trajectory. Russia is spending soldiers at a dramatically higher rate per unit of territory gained than it was a year ago. Its oil revenues have declined sharply. Its deficit plan was consumed in 90 days. And yet its defense industry, per Rostec data cited by Dr. Smart, fulfilled 99.5% of its orders last year. The war machine is still running, at increasing cost. How long that remains sustainable is the central unanswered question. And the fifth takeaway is structural and longer term. The world's trade architecture is exposed in ways that the Hormuz closure is now making impossible to ignore. The WTO Director General named 4 choke points, Hormuz, Malacca, Panama, Suez, as a collective systemic vulnerability. 2 of them are currently compromised. The institutions and policy frameworks that govern global trade were not designed for this level of simultaneous physical disruption. That gap is going to demand attention. This has been The Briefing Desk for the 17th of April, 2026. Every claim you heard today was sourced. Every figure was attributed. Where limitations existed in the sourcing, we told you. That is the standard this desk holds. We will return when the record develops further. Until then, stay informed, stay grounded, and trust the evidence.